Hi, welcome back to the Mob Mentality Show. My name is Austin Chadwick and co-host is Chris Lucian. And very excited to have Skylar Watson joining us today. Got some really interesting topics that I'm excited to jump into and discuss, including some kind of global mobbing sessions he had going on, kind of a journey he had coaching a team that started to exclusively mob, and some there's some details there. And then also we got lined up his book on refactoring to services. So, before we jump into all that, Skylar, can you introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for the introduction. My name's Skylar Watson. I'm currently working as a software craftsmanship and process coach. I've been coaching for the last 10 to 12 years. And prior to that, I was a software developer. So I've had the amazing opportunity to travel the world. I spent about 6 to 7 years on the road, about 250 days a year, and had an opportunity to travel and work in about 10 different countries. So it's been a great ride, and I've had a lot of fun.
Right on, right on. Good stuff. And so, we've heard a little bit about how a few years ago you had 5 different countries running a global mobbing session that would go 24 hours for several days. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Like, how did it get started?
Yeah, so this was for a manufacturing company, and the system controlled the plant floor. So if the system was down, vehicles aren't being produced, which is kind of a big deal when you're trying to, produce vehicles. And so we were trying to find opportunities to move stuff to the cloud, make the application a little bit more performant, reliable. And so I was working with the team as a coach. And so we started doing some pairing sessions and mobbing sessions. And somebody made the comment of overlap, where at the time, I guess I can give some context here. I'm working and living in Iowa. We had developers in Michigan. We had a developer in Kentucky. We had several developers in Spain, Germany, Netherlands, and India. So we had people spread out all over the world in several different time zones. And so the thought came up of we could have that 2-hour overlap in the morning for pairing, or we could or mobbing, or we could just keep it going round the clock. And so one reason for starting that is the engineers, if the engineers in India were logging off at 8 a.m., that next day they might be picking up a different story, or they might have 2 stories in flight depending on if they're pairing or not pairing. And so the idea was, well, let's work on the highest priority story and keep that story in progress until it's complete. And the theory was, by doing so, we would increase our throughput and decrease our cycle time. And so that was the hypothesis going into this. And we wanted to see if this was something that we could, was tangible, feasible. So we started up a mobbing session, and as people would log off for the day, their day was ending, they would log off, and around that time people were logging on, and we just had this nonstop motion of a pairing or mobbing session that went Monday to Friday with no stopping in between. People logged on when they were ready to work, and they logged off when it was time for them to go home. So it was a pretty interesting experiment to run, and we did keep track of our throughput and cycle time, and we did in fact have a significant increase in our throughput, and we did decrease our cycle time. So fun experiment. It was interesting to try, and it was awesome to be able to have the ability to experiment with that with the team being as distributed as it was.
Nice. How long was the overlap period between the like 2 time zones or 2 teams passing off the story?
Yeah, we would generally have a about a 3 to 4 hour overlap with everybody. So it wasn't enough time to be able to have the context switch if I'm working, you know, throughout the day and I finish a story and picking something up, like a new story. It was long enough, in my opinion, to be able to have the context switch, be able to onboard something, somebody to pair on that story or give them the context that they may have missed out over the day. But yeah, about 3 to 4 hours was that overlap.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm excited about this story because it's something I've been thinking about a lot. It's interesting. So how did everybody on the team feel about context, I guess, through this? Because sometimes I think you know, there's a lot of anxiety around passing context from one group to the next and things like that. So do you have anything on that came up?
There was, there was questions in the beginning, and the way that we advertised it, so to speak, maybe that's the wrong word to use, but the way that we, lack of better words, the way that we advertised it to the team or discussed it amongst the team was, hey, there's new practices that we want to try. So I was on the team as a XP coach, helping the team get used to test-driven development. We talked about, you know, test first versus test-driven. What's the difference between the two? And so the way that we pitched this experiment was, hey, it's an opportunity for us to work on new practices that maybe we haven't tried before in a larger group, where we can have some overlap with everybody on the team as a whole. And so that was how it started. It started out as an experiment to try new practices on. And from there, it kind of evolved into, hey, this is actually more productive than what we thought it would be. But yeah, it was absolutely something that people weren't really thrilled about the idea from the standpoint of what you said of, yeah, it's a lot of context switching.
Yeah. I know that when I really like the practice of leaving the code base at the end of the day with a failing test. Was there anything along the, you know, so you have context, I guess, for the next day. Was there any strategies for maintaining context in between rotations or anything like that? Or was it just the overlap was the handoff time?
The overlap was the handoff time. Okay. As people would come on, we would have, you know, like a 10 minute, you know, spiel of, hey, this is where we're at, or, hey, this is where I left off yesterday. Where are we at today? And so we did have that intentional conversation of like, hey, let's not just start coding without the context, because context is missing there. It from one perspective, I worked on a team, which this is a different story, but I worked on a team where we switched pairs twice a day. And the reason I mentioned this was, you know, context, right? And on that team, I was the biggest person against that. I'm like, no, if I'm picking up a story, I want to work on the story. I want that context. I want to feel like I accomplished something. And what I found was switching to that style or approach of switching off more frequently and not having the context, or not having the ownership, rather, I guess is a better way to put it, made me less stressed. Because then I'm going, like, I don't feel like I'm burdened with the story. I don't feel like I'm burdened with the responsibility of, I mean, obviously there's still responsibility. I'm part of the team, but it's the team ownership opposed to, you know, Skylar owns this and Skylar individually has the responsibility of if it fails or passes. So from that aspect, like I said, this whole idea of switching so frequently in the beginning, myself, I was totally against it. And then as I experienced it, I'm like, wait, this is like, I feel like I can enjoy life a little bit more because I don't feel as burdened.
Yeah, I definitely feel that sentiment. I like the idea that you can kind of walk away and come back. I don't know, you know, I do run into it a lot where the context is just so important to some people. And so, as we have, people rotating off and on mobs and other things like that, that's always kind of, becomes the crux of the conversation. And so, I think that you know, it's likely that the increase in or the reduction in cycle time and the increase of throughput is extremely valuable, especially in an emergency situation. Like I think it would be perfect for that as well. If there was something that you needed to get it to a customer as fast as possible, but in order to be effective like that, you might need practice, right? And so, yeah, it's a cool story.
And I think part of that. Oh, go ahead.
No, please go ahead. Yeah.
I think an important thing to point out with anything, just because that works for that particular team at that time, doesn't mean that it you know will work with that team. And at some point, I know they stopped doing that after I left the team. I know they continued practicing that for a while. But then priority changed, the problems they were trying to solve changed. And so that was the right thing to experiment with the team at that time, but that's not the solution for, you know, for every team or for every problem. So.
Nice. Yeah. What was funny is one of the first software jobs I had was supporting a nuclear power plant. And what I noticed in several pieces of the software, whether it was, you know, security rounds or operation rounds or logbooks and things like that, is they had this idea of shift turnover from like, you know, like the day shift to the night shift to the, you know, the different shifts. And so when you were describing it, it felt really similar to that, where they had that, they always had a period of overlap where they would pass the context of, you know, what hot items were to keep an eye on and things like that. And so I found that pretty interesting. One thing that jumped out to me is he said at the beginning of this experiment, some people were not thrilled. And so how did they feel after some time? Were they still nervous? What was their experience like?
Yeah, and so the way that we framed it was, hey, this is an experiment, and in all experiments, you should be time boxed. So we did time box it, and I can't remember what that initial time box was, but it was like, I don't know, maybe a week. So hey, let's start this on Monday. Let's do it to Friday, see how it goes. And after Friday, those of you who are interested in continuing to do this, hey, we can keep it going. And if you don't want to, then hey, law of mobility, you know, log off and do solo work, pick up your own story. And so we empowered people to opt in or opt out. And what we found was that the whole team continued to be a part of it beyond that first week, beyond the second week, beyond the third week. So the people that were initially skeptical about it, I guess, changed their mind because they continued to be part of the session. So.
Right on.
Cool. Well, it might be a good time to transition to the next topic. So still on the topic of mobbing, and so you, it sounds like you had a story where you were mobbing exclusively and you had some interactions with the VP about throughput. You want to share some more on that?
Yeah, so that was a fun team. We had a team where I think this is maybe pretty typical, where some teams get have a large backlog of work to do, and everything is number one priority. And so we experienced that on one of these teams where everything was the number one priority. There was also multiple I don't want to say product owners, but work was coming in through the team through multiple avenues, and everybody thought that their thing was the thing that needed to get done first. And so a way to solve that was, you know what, the team's just going to mob. And if everybody is working together as a single unit or as a mob, then we can only work on one thing. And the reason for doing that was we had so many number one priorities and so many conflicting priorities that nothing was getting done, because what I'm working on this morning might not be what I'm working on this afternoon because I was just told to work on something else. And a period of enough time went on where the business started giving us feedback that we weren't being productive and we needed to change how we were working. So we exclusively started to mob and push back of, okay, well, we can only do one thing at a time. And what is that thing you want us to do? And it was pretty fun experiment. And we started to realize that, you know, you have your typical roles, the driver, the navigator, the mob. We started experimenting with the different roles. If we had something where maybe we know that we need to connect to a database and AWS, like how can I do this thing that I've never done before? So I need to connect to DynamoDB from my Lambda, and we've not done that before as a team. How does that work? We're not to that yet, but we might get there in the next hour or two where we're ready to implement that code. And so then we would have somebody that's part of the mob grab their laptop. They would still be part of the group, part of the circle, but they would be doing research on the problem that we're trying to solve. So that way, when we get to that point, we're not blocked. We can keep going. And so what we were trying to do with that was reduce the we were trying to prevent us from doing mob research. And that works pretty well. Another thing that I joked about was like a Periscope. So that was a role in the sense that there was one day where one of the managers pulled me back because he wanted to talk about a prior meeting. And so we're having a conversation, but my eyes were on the mob screens. And I was far enough away where I couldn't see the code, but close enough to where I could see the pattern of the code. And it's like, and that was a really interesting experience because I'm like, wow, from this view, like I can totally see that there's a smell and like the I was able to identify some patterns. Like, hey, this code might need, you know, XYZ patterns. And the manager's like, well, why do you say that? I'm like, well, you see how it's structured? And so that was just an interesting thought. And so when I went back to the team, I gave my input. And so some of the team members like went back, you know, 20 paces, and they're like, oh, I see what you're saying now. And so we had fun with it. We made different roles based on the problems that we knew we were going to need to solve, or based on the number of people that were part of the mob. If we had questions that we knew we were going to need answered, you know, somebody would break off, go get the questions. And what we found over time was, again, cycle time reduced, throughput increased. One of the BAs on the team, or product owners, did a tweet and said, made a comment, I can't remember what the tweet was, but something to the effect of, my team has never been so productive since they started mobbing, or something. Like something to the effect that now that we're mobbing, we're able to get more work done in a shorter amount of time. And the CIO, I believe it was, saw that tweet, and or VP over IT, one of the two. And so we got called into one of his boardroom meetings to talk with him and his direct reports of, hey, what's this mobbing thing all about? And like tell us the story. How does it work? And so we brought an engineer with, and he shared the mechanics of, you know, what is mobbing, how does mobbing work. And then me and the developer manager talked about what we said was the business value. So like, this is the business value of mobbing. And there was a couple moments of silence, and it's like, oh no. the response I was not expecting. The response was, how can we get everybody in the organization to mob? And it's like, okay, yep. That's great. But again, just because that worked with this team doesn't mean it's going to work with every team. And so that I thought was a pretty cool story where we went from not being able to get any work done because we had conflicting priority. Everybody was telling us to do something different, and we put our foot down as a team and said, hey, no, we can only work on one thing because we're working as a mob, and there's no way we can handle more than one work or more than one item. So what is the number one priority based on the organizational needs? And that's how they started prioritizing work was but a lot of organizations has a priority at the organizational level. And so let's use that to determine the priority of the work. And we will work on those items as a one cohesive unit. So.
Nice.
Yeah, that, I think I hear that often, not even necessarily in the context of mobbing, but that teams are being thrashed in general. They're just like constantly put on different things. And when you point it out, it might be like, oh yeah, maybe we shouldn't be doing that, right? But sometimes it's just not super apparent. And so, yeah, I love the story.
Yeah, and what's interesting to me is I've seen the work in progress as one, the whip of one, as like a side effect of mobbing. And it's usually not the first thing I think of as the reason why to start mobbing. It's the way you described it is interesting to think of it as like it's a way, you know, I've heard of ways before. We have the Kanban board and you force the whip of one by just like watching the board and like, I don't know, slapping people's hands when they go for another sticky or something. Where the mob way to do it is a really interesting constraint. Like we'll do it via mob. And I don't know, that just spurred some thoughts onto me. I could see it being viewed as quite imposing and getting some big reactions. Did it at the time when it was brought in for that reason?
It did. It got some reactions from the developers. It got some reactions from the some of the business partners. So and the developers were more from the standpoint of doing full stack development, opposed to I'm an iOS developer, I'm an Android developer, I'm a, you know, Java developer, I'm a, you know, front end developer. So from that aspect, the team was like, I don't really know how to do this. And it's like, yeah, that's fine. We'll figure it out together. And again, we'll run a test experiment. We'll do it for a week. If it doesn't work, then we'll try something else. The beautiful part about this too was the idea didn't come from me as a coach. It came from the dev manager. And that I thought was kind of a really cool thing to see. And he wasn't imposing it on the team of like, thou shalt do this. It was, hey, I really think this would be a good idea for this reason. You're all stressed out because work keeps changing on you. This is a way, like this is a thing we could experiment with to see if your stress reduces. Yes, you have concerns of not knowing, you know, knowing the other code. But if we try this for a week and see if some of those larger problems that you're facing are reduced or go away, then like, hey, then maybe it was worth it. So, and then the business partners, you know, have that natural reaction of like, but now we're getting less work done because everybody's working on one thing. So, we were, I don't want to say challenged, but there was opportunities for conversation on both fronts there.
Yeah, I find that developers that are worried about not knowing another framework or something, I think once they realize that the other person in the mob has the syntax, then algorithms still flow out, right? And so I think like that anxiety hopefully goes away pretty quickly because you basically say like, oh, I don't know how to write it in this language, but we, you know, we should iterate over a list and do this, or, you know, use a hash map here or anything along those lines. And I think that comfort increases when somebody's like, oh, I know the syntax for that. Let's just go ahead and, you know, do this and that. And so you can have, you know, very like T-shaped developers all get together on a mob. And even if they touch different things, that like generic computer science piece, I think ends up coming out and moving things a lot faster anyway. And so that's just a theory around that, but,
well, absolutely agree. I think another way to put that, or the way that I rationalize it, is as human beings, do we think better by ourselves or when we're around other people? And, generally the response is you think better when you have somebody to bounce ideas off of. So you think better in a group. And that's what most, in my opinion, most of software development is. It's thinking through a problem to try to find a solution. Writing code is the easy part. Like, it doesn't take much time to write code. The time consuming part is thinking through the problem.
Yeah.
And to your point, I was working on, I had an engagement where I did, was working with the team on Perl. It's been a very long time, like at least a decade since I'd done Perl, and not in a professional setting either. And so when I was working on this 4 million line code Perl project, I was like, I don't know what type of value I can add here, but we'll see. But I was happy that I had no Perl experience because I was able to be naive and ask naive questions. And we were able to reduce a lot of duplication and redundancy that wasn't necessary in the Perl code just because I didn't know the language. And I was able to be, hey, what's this? And they were trying to justify what they were. I'm like, no, like I genuinely don't know what that code does. And so I was able to ask these questions. It just looked funny to me. And so I was able to ask questions, and they were responding, and I asked more questions, and they're saying, well, are you saying we don't need this? No, I'm just trying to understand how this works. And so they're like, you know what? You're right. We don't need this. And I was like, all right. I don't know. I'm just asking questions. And so that from that standpoint, I thought that was really productive engagement because I was able to ask questions based on what I was seeing and help them come up with help them generate those thoughts and ideas based on the questions I was asking. So
nice. Yeah, I think you're right. The fresh eyes helps. It's like it's almost like a different version of when you were 20 feet back, right? It's like, I understand very little of this. So you notice different things than the people who are looking at, like, you know, the five characters of this word to know what to type next. Another cool thing I notice about being in a mob where you don't know the language or the technology stack, it's almost like the magical experience when you're talking with someone in another language and you have a translator where you like say something and then like, whoa, someone translates and these cool words come out that I don't understand, but we're actually communicating, you know. And I had that experience many years ago with JavaScript and mobbing, where I just was in the mob sitting there and then just partaking in the discussion, and then magically JavaScript that I didn't know very well was showing up on the screen and it was solving the problem. It was like, whoa, this is quite engaging. It's quite engaging way to learn it. And then pretty soon it becomes I guess by immersion the language you can work with yourself. But Yeah, good stuff. One thing you said earlier I wanted to ask on a little bit. So you said the VP said, because this is a common thing, I think, in many ways with management is, oh, here's a good thing. Everyone do this thing. You know what I mean? Like, which is awesome because he saw, you know, experiment work out well and want it to grow. How did you take it from that to what happened next in that organization? Did it literally become an edict of some kind, or something else kind of happen?
No. So the response that we gave was, we're glad you see the value in this. We're glad that this worked for the team and you're able to see the value. But just because that worked with this team doesn't mean it's going to work with every team. We were using mobbing as an implementation to solve a problem. And if other teams within the organization have that same problem, then absolutely. We can, you know, here are strategies where we can roll that out to other teams. With that being said, this may not work with every team in the organization because every team is different. And so we had that mutual understanding. And as teams had similar, faced with similar problems, then we, you know, made our suggestions and had the data from the other team to be able to support it. That was how we handled that conversation. Was just, hey, it worked for this team for these reasons, and we're glad you see the value. And that was pretty much that.
Was it broadcast at all to others or anything like that? Was it like a recognized success and or buy-in, or did it just kind of like go quietly from there?
So we had this was all on site and was open floor plan. Everybody within that floor, knew what was going on just cause we rearranged furniture and, you know, we sat on couches and, stuff like that. So everybody walking by was like, hey, what's going on over there? Like, they look like they're having more fun than we are. So from that aspect, it was broadcasted through the, being visible.
Or kind of organic and
right.
Do you know of any other teams that adopted it based on your experience or you know, from that observation or anything along those lines? Or
there were some other teams that I think there was three, maybe four other teams that were mobbing as well.
Cool.
And I don't really know the details of how that went. I mean, I knew they were doing it for a long period of time and it seemed like it was working well. So yeah, I think on our floor, we had maybe three, four teams that were mobbing.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, we the team, our team before mobbing, it was like everything was very interrupt driven. And this development team back then, this is like 12 years ago now, this development team was in a IS department and everything was like ticket driven. And so people would put in tickets, but then somebody might come up to your desk and talk to you. And so there were people that were afraid to talk to other people because they would just get almost yelled at for not putting in the ticket. And so it's funny because after mobbing, we would hear like, people would be walking up and they'd be like, oh, they're in a meeting. And then they walk away. And so it kind of naturally happened that way anyway. And yeah, there was no intention around reducing thrashing per se there. We ended up requiring one product owner for any initiative, even though if there were many stakeholders. And so, but, you know, kind of to the point of your story, we certainly experienced far less thrashing. And one of the effects was just somebody that would have walked up to a developer and asked them to change course. They were actually uncomfortable interrupting a meeting that was going on.
That's definitely, it's interesting because from what you mentioned and the story that I shared, it's using, taking like these technical practices and using them as an implementation as opposed to like a blueprint or a stencil that we're trying to force on the team. Right. And I think far too often, at least I've seen where organizations try to push the stencil of Agile or XP or, you know, whatever thing that, you know, whatever the thing is. And instead of saying, you know what, we have this problem that we're trying to solve and how can we solve it? What's the best way to solve this problem? It's like, oh, well, mobbing will help us solve the problem for these reasons, or continuous integration will solve our problem for these reasons, or TDD, whatever it may be. And so I think far too often, we get in that trap of wanting to do all these practices because we see some teams have had success with it. And so we just assume if we implement it in the same way, we're going to see that same success.
Nice. Right on. Well, that was awesome hearing those mobbing stories, whether the global one or the kind of this glass house one that got up to the VP level. In other news, so to speak, we've written a book on refactoring to services. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so this was a long project that I'd worked on. So it is a book titled Refactoring to Services, like you mentioned, and the effectively a workshop that I put together that I turned into a book. And it stemmed from a project I worked on back in, 2012, 13 timeframe, where we had to take a monolith and we had to extract a microservice from a monolith. And the feeling on the team at the time was we can't do this without branching. And so we challenged each other of, well, but is that true? And so after thinking through it, we found different abstraction layers and different strategies that we could implement to be able to do continuous integration, trunk-based development, and extract that service. And so as I started consulting and jumping around to different clients, I noticed this same trend. We have this large scale project, whether it be monolith to microservice or something similar, a large initiative, and that general feeling of you can't do large scale refactorings without branching. And so I found myself having the same conversations over and over again. So the book was a way for me to write down my thoughts, so I didn't have to like rethink every year of like, what, how did I explain this last time? And also be able to provide an example that I could walk through with teams and individuals on teams. Because a lot of times people are like, cool, I hear what you're saying, but do you have a concrete example we can walk through? And so it was my book was a workshop that I would walk developers through on how we could do a large scale refactoring using a extraction of a service as an example, to be able to eliminate branches and be able to be on green bar the whole time. So that was the other important part, is we want to be able to not only do frequent micro commits, but make sure we don't break anything at the same time. So that is the general gist of that.
Yeah, I've recently seen the value of this quite a bit. Anytime you're able to work, like you said, trunk based development, small commits, always green. It's always peaceful, and you can start and stop at any time. And then whenever I was part of something where part of the work was not done that way. And it's amazing how everything comes to a halt. All the queues start picking up because like, oh, someone just ripped out an engine of one part of the code base and it's untouchable or unusable for so many days or this amount of time. And it's amazing to see all the lean waste start popping up as soon as that happens, and all this extra work and all this kind of thing. I hadn't experienced that for a while, and I experienced it again, and it's always a grounding experience. I guess maybe that leads to my question is, what led you to doing it that way? Was it bad experiences like me, or how did you find the way to extracting in these small steps?
I think part of it was stubbornness. I don't like not knowing things, from the stance of I felt like there should be a feasible, or I felt like everything could be done in small commits, and I wanted to challenge that hypothesis of whether or not that was true. And so I think it stemmed from that, lack of better word, stubbornness of is this a true statement or not. And from there, had evening projects where I would, create a code base or something, and then be like, okay, so here's what we're starting with, and this is what I want to get to. Let's refactor it and see how we can, have a commit every 5 minutes or whatever it is. And so I just had a series of projects that I created, in the evenings, and just to try to challenge myself of, is this a true hypothesis, or am I crazy in that thought?
Yeah, I certainly like this idea. There was one project that I think a team was having a similar problem with, and so I kind of worked with them and kind of guided through adding a dependency injection platform and allowing newer technologies to be used with older technologies, and gradually making it so that everything could be decoupled from the old implementation but still worked on, and even with like a redundant or replace model where two things are operating identically but one in an old technology and one in a new. I found many code bases that people believe they can't do trunk based development on, but I haven't found one that you actually can't do trunk based development on. And so I think it's about risk and anxiety and coupling and things like that. So I totally feel that.
Well, the other aspect of that too, like in addition to that, I think all of those things are certainly true. And the additional thing is it's a different mindset. So the way that we're taught how to write code doesn't always coincide with, trunk-based development and being on, just not having branches. And so like in the book, some of the things that I talk about is if you're changing a method signature, do you do an inside-out approach or outside-in? Or if you're changing a return type, inside out or outside in, and these things, if you those types of things where generally we don't think about that, right? Generally you're like, yeah, I'm going to change the return type, and you know, whatever the compiler tells me I need to fix, I'll fix, and that's fine. And in some cases the compiler rash is small enough to where you can easily get away with that. And some repositories, if you do that, you'll get, you know, 10,000 compile errors. So, but again, I was doing this as a kata of, okay, this, some of these changes might be small and seem ridiculous, but is there a way where we can do this large refactoring where, these little things, writing software in this slightly different way, allows us to be on green bar, which, you know, there's a lot of benefits of being able to do micro commits and continuous integration. So,
yeah, one thing that came up recently was someone in the mob was showing us quite a bit of Git skills and branching skills, and you know, and at the time it was needed, but it made me realize how much my Git foo has dwindled because there's just like no need for it, at least in my experience of trunk-based development. It's just like, oh, the thing we do a million times a month is small commit, push, small commit, push, small commit, push, like merge, what? You know what I mean? Like, and so when someone was showing all this off, I was kind of like, not showing it off in a bad way, but just kind of like demonstrating the mob some of these things. I was like, wow, I think I used to know some of this, but I've completely forgotten. So, so I guess the follow-up question is, do you think that matters?
from what standpoint?
I don't know. Like
the erosion of Git skills? Is that what you're saying? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I had the same thing happen yesterday, because I don't create branches either. And yesterday I learned that there is a new-ish Git command called Git switch, where you can switch branches with Git switch instead of Git checkout. I'm like, hey, I don't know the difference between Git checkout and Git switch, because I learned that's a thing yesterday. And part of me is like, is that? Like I feel that it's wrong that I didn't know that that's a command that Git added. And on the other hand, I'm like, I also don't feel bad that I didn't know that was a command.
Yeah, it's funny because I think, you know, I think people that are really, really good with Git they've had some really bad experiences in Git. And they had to work their way through it. And so, like the detached heads and all the other like weirdness that you can get into yourself into. And so, the people that I think of that, you know, like bail people out, of bad situations with their Git foo, you know, I think that a lot of it was just like ingrained muscle memory from like terrible things happening. And so, yeah, you know, if you have a high level of safety, then maybe you should look for an erosion of those skills as a positive attribute.
You know, that's a really good spin on that. I like it, because there's a couple months ago, I was pairing with somebody, and I don't think we need this code. And I said, all right. So without even thinking, I need to Git reset hard. And they're like, whoa, dude, like what'd you do? We can't get that back. I wasn't sure if we needed it or not. I'm like, you gave me the impression we didn't need it. Like, oh no, it's lost. And so then I went back and I threw the Git ref log and pulled back the commit, and it's like, we can get it back. No, we can pull it back. And it's like, I don't know, I don't want to know how you know how to do that. It's like, yeah, like you said, it was pain.
Yeah.
I've had this pain in the past where I've gotten rid of stuff that I maybe shouldn't have, and you know, like that's ingrained in me. And to your point, that probably wouldn't be a bad thing if some of those things are rewriting Git history. I had to do that throughout this book, because each chapter of the book I have its own branch, and which is both good and bad, in the sense of, if I get to the last chapter, I'm like, oh yeah, this doesn't work. Now I have to or something was missing that should have been in the first chapter. Like, okay, well, how do I do this? Mm-hmm. So I got really good at rewriting Git history.
Nice.
Throughout the process of writing this book, I'm like, yeah, that's a skill that I really shouldn't have, because in production, you never want to rewrite Git history in production. That can have some serious consequences. So from that aspect, the erosion would certainly be a good thing, right? So
yeah. So congratulations, Austin. Your forgetting is a positive attribute.
Yes.
Yeah. And I know you got to close it down, Chris, but just the Git pain. I remember a team I was on a while ago. Something went really bad. Something really bad happened because we were doing kind of everyone had their own branch and merges and all that kind of stuff going on. And there was the one guy we had on the team called the Git Doctor, and like something was terribly broken. And so everyone was just standing around his cubicle as he was like doing his magic for several hours to like resurrect this code base so we didn't like lose weeks of work or something. Yeah.
All right. Well, before we close it down, Skylar, do you have anything that you'd want to plug or share? I guess including the book.
So like you mentioned, just got that published last month. It's called Refactoring Services. Some of the code example, I wrote it in 2018, and then I didn't get it published until recently. So some of the code examples and dependencies, probably a little out of date for that reason of imposter syndrome and not wanting to publish the book. And then in March, I will have a second book released called Visualizing Empowerment, which is on using data to drive conversations about empowerment, where you can see the difference in leadership's perspective of how a team is empowered compared to how a team themselves feel empowered. So pretty excited about that one as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you for being on the show. And to our audience, if you know anybody that could use some good stories about very big experiments, or maybe they're being thrashed a lot and could use a story around thrashing and fixing that, or if you know somebody that needs to forget well, then maybe share this episode with them. From there, please talk to us in the comments about everything going on. And we usually send all the chats to our interview members, so you can certainly get a hold of Skylar through some of these chats as well. And subscribe, hit the notification bell, and we'll see you all next time. Thank you for listening. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for the invite. Yeah.